25 years ago, the United Nations held its fourth, and so far final, World Conference on Women. Events began August 30, 1995, in Wairo, China, and concluded September 15 in Beijing. The one-week non-governmental forum hosted more than 30,000 people. The official meeting had more than 17,000 from 189 countries. This was not a one-off event. Numerous national, regional, and international meetings were held to prepare for it, and many more since, seeking implementation of the plan of action that governments unanimously approved. This week, and for the 2 weeks that follow, WINGS commemorates the conference with stories from 1995.
The Chinese Lexicon Project, created by Sharon Hom, was explained in detail in Oklahoma City at an official U.S. preparatory meeting for the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women. Sharon Hom teaches law at the City University of New York School of Law and in China.
In Tianjin last year, I did a workshop with Chinese women, about 100, and I said, I want you to come up with the first saying in Chinese that you can think of that has to do with Chinese women. Now, these are women who do work on women's issues. So we came up with a list, and then I looked at the list. Every one of them was negative. So I said, this underscores the importance of paying attention to how we talk and to create new language.
The Lexicon Project was born out of the first joint conference of women scholars from China and the U.S.
There was a very ritzy conference funded with lots of money, and this was the first time for many of those Chinese women outside of China. And there were panels and workshops on gender and reproduction and everything else, except law, interestingly. So I was astounded by the presentations. And the one that really triggered it for me was to listen to a panel of all white Western women talking about Chinese women's subjectivity. And then when someone talked about the provisional contingent and what Chinese women need to do was to claim their alternative subject positionalities, my eyes crossed. And I looked at my Chinese counterparts and I said, gosh, what is going through those headphones? How could that have been translated into Chinese? And I would like to know what it was, right? And then in the question and answer, I got up and I went to the mic and I said, I'm sorry, I didn't have a headphone on, but I would like to know what the translation was for counter-hegemonic reification. And furthermore, what does it mean in English? So there were, and when I said the question, and then the question was easily translated to Chinese, the Chinese looked up and started laughing. So that made me start thinking. So I started talking to the women in the hallways, the Chinese women from China, and they said to me, and what work unit are you from? Because in China, everyone belongs to a work unit, a danwei. I said, my work unit is the City University of New York Law School, and I'm based in New York. And we started talking about the words that people were using and absolutely assuming, you know, was being translated. And I'll tell you just the three that got me thinking about the project. Gender was translated many different ways. None of them had any correlation to what, even in this room of us here, might even agree was a definition of gender. In the Chinese, every version came out with the clear connotation that this was biologically determined. The other big word was sexuality. Now, we know there's sex in China. That's why we're having this big problem with trying to do this population thing, right? The problem was we couldn't translate sexuality because sexuality has connotations of pleasure and passion and sex for sex's sake and not reproduction or trying to produce the son. And they couldn't come up with a word for sexuality, so the word came up something mumbled like sex, you know, something like that, you know? And then the other word was feminist. And so the translations for that was nuquanzhuyi, which is very bad. It has this absolutely militant, angry, in-your-face, I don't care about you, women's rights. So that was one problem with the definition. The other problem with the words they were using was that feminism in China is state-sponsored. It's viewed as the policy of the party. So you will find many Chinese who will say, I am not feminist. And the struggle to claim those labels and to reject those labels will be absolutely what will be going on. And what you're going to get then, in contrast to that, is a very vocal, I will bet, group of primarily young women who will speak a discourse that you will feel comfortable with, so the danger will be that you will talk to just them. These are women who have read and want to talk to you about Gloria Steinem. These are the women who will talk to you of Western feminism and women's rights and claiming our voices, and will say it in English to you. None of this translates easily into Chinese. So that was the main impetus for the Lexicon Project. My co-editor is a human rights scholar from Beijing, so she's the China contact person, and I'm the US contact person. And we are editing a lexicon, which we hope will fit in your back pocket, because I will, those of you who are there can come and find me and pay me my dollar, because I will bet my bottom dollar that your translators may not be able to find the quick word for sexuality, but you will find it in our book. So what we will have in the lexicon are not translations of all the words, because that's the problem. So what we will have is the word, and then there will be a suggested Chinese word, but then we're going to do like a paragraph on each of these words that says, this is why the word is difficult. This is why it's hard to use the word. So we have 300 words, and in the dictionary of 300 words, I don't want to use dictionary, so that's why we're using lexicon. A lot of the words are starred. The starred words are our real upfront owning up to saying, these words either do not currently exist in Chinese, and we know it, so we're making up a word. Where we say very clearly, we say, this is about creating a new language in Chinese so we can talk to each other about terms we need to use.
That was Sharon Hom, originator of the Chinese Lexicon Project. The Fourth World Conference on Women will be held in Beijing in September 1995. Reporting for Wings, this is Lisa Hayes.
One of the controversies of the coming Fourth World Conference on Women centers around whether or not women exiled from Tibet will be allowed by the Chinese government to attend. China has occupied Tibet since the 1940s and has forced Tibetans to conform to Chinese ways. Listeners Lobsang Dechen of the Tibetan Nun Project expresses her concerns.
As I'm a nun, I'm concerned about so many nuns in the prisons. They went for the peaceful demonstration. They wanted to express their abuse. They wanted to express their sufferings. They're put in prison, they torture them, and there's no right of expression.
The Chinese government handpicked 80 Tibetan women to attend the conference, but Tibetan exiles want their own representatives. Tsering Norzom is the president of the Tibetan Women's Association, an independent Tibetan organization.
We have evident proof that the Tibetan women who live as refugees in exile will be denied access to participate in the conference, because the All China Women's Federation representative, she made it clear that Tibet is an internal part of China and that they will be dealt according to the Chinese law. And further to add to it, when I approached Mrs. Gertrude Mongela, the General Secretary of the Fourth World Conference on Women, and apprised her about the access problems that the Tibetan women who live as refugees might face, she said that Tibetan women from Tibet have already registered for the conference and that we coordinate with them.
Yang Ying is a Tibetan woman who did not choose exile. She was elected by the Chinese government as president of the Women's Federation of Tibet. She explains that the only way the exiled women can attend the World Conference on Women in China is if they renounce their independent Tibetan citizenship and enter as Chinese citizens. Here is Yang Ying in translation.
As a woman, personally, they have the right to attend the conference. But if they practice independence, Tibetan independence, this will be not allowed by people from Tibetan Autonomous Region. So if they recognize themselves as a citizen or as a woman from Tibetan Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China and applied to Tibetan Women's Federation, as a member of Tibetan women's delegation, then it's okay.
Tsering Norzom responds.
those Tibetan women who will be brought into the conference by the Chinese government will not be able to speak the true situation of the Tibetan women inside Tibet, because they will be made to speak under pressure and threat for themselves and for their families, which means that they will say that everything in the status of Tibetan women inside Tibet is fine. And so we as Tibetan women who live in exile as refugees, who have maximum number of freedom, we speak as the voice, as the true voice of every Tibetan woman in and outside Tibet, and it is our moral responsibility to see that the true situation of the Tibetan women is highlighted in this conference, and that women of the world take note of the sufferings that the Tibetan women have been undergoing under the Chinese oppression inside Tibet and outside Tibet.
Yang Ying, the official representative, calls the independent Tibetan women troublemakers. Her view is that the Tibetan women in China are living happy lives, and the women of the world will see for themselves when they come for the conference.
I think all the people, except those people who have a hostile attitude, are welcome. And you can see the changes of Tibetan people with your own eyes.
What others call the occupation of Tibet, Yang Ying calls the liberation of Tibet by China. She says that when she was a child, Tibet was under a feudal system and her family were serfs.
From 8 to 15 years old, I was a serf for a noble family, and the life was miserable. And when Tibet was liberated, that was in the year 1959, I had a chance to go to school and to the university. And I got a job upon graduation to do women's work. And I have been doing this for many years. And now I'm the chairwoman of the Tibetan Women's Federation. Now my husband has his job. I have two daughters and two grandchildren. And the family is very happy and harmonious.
Those were representatives of both sides of the controversy surrounding the denial of access by the Chinese government to independent Tibetan women wanting to attend the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. Interviews were recorded by Maria Suarez and Elaine Clift. Reporting for Wings, I'm Lisa Hayes.
From the Wings Archive, these are stories about the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women in 1995.
During the first week in September, the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women will be held in Beijing, China. The China Organizing Committee is responsible for the preparations for the non-governmental forum on women taking place alongside the official conference. Huang Qizhao is vice chairperson of the committee. The translator is Sun Hua Yan.
Now I would like to give you some of the names of the workshops.
妇女与科技发展,
Women and Science and Technology,
妇女与企业管理,
Women and Business Management,
妇女与工业发展,
Rural Women,
农村妇女,
Women of Ethnic Groups,
少数民族妇女,
Disabled Women,
老年妇女, 残疾妇女, 女童, 妇女与信贷,
Women and Credit, Women and the Traditional Chinese Traditional Medicine, Legal Status of Women, Women and Human Rights, Violences Against Women.
对妇女的暴力.
And Girls.
Do you think that having the conference in China will have a big effect on women's relationship with the government and to each other after the conference is over?
Half of the provinces, they have put a significantly greater amount of money for women's affairs, for the construction of women's activity centers. These activity centers are to provide services and skill training for the women in their localities. I'm not sure whether you have such kind of facilities for women, but in our country, such kind of facilities and constructions are going all out everywhere. And with the financial support of our government, the CWF is now constructing a national women's activity center, which covers an area of 36,000 square meters. This center will be completed before the convening of the conference.
中国的妇女都可以进去，这个中心呢就建在北京的最著名的街道长安街上。And this
center is located in Beijing on the Chang'e Street, the most famous street in Beijing. And every woman, all the women, they can be there to have activities, such as providing services and training, skill training. So rural women, they can come to Beijing and stay there for a period of time.
还举一个例子，就是为了迎接这个大会，我们全国妇联。
Another thing I would like to share with you is that now in China, the women are building a China College for Women. This is a college for women exclusively, we can say that. And the money is raised by women themselves. But of course, we get some support from the central government. This support totaled 10 million yuan, 10 million yuan. The rest is raised by the women themselves. Before the convening of the conference and NGO forum, this college will be open to students. 6 subjects departments will recruit students. Law, economic management, preschool education administration, foreign languages, secretary, and social work.
同时呢, 我们积极地为参与第44届妇女大会的非政府组织论坛呢, 进行这个会场的设施的准备。
Another thing, we have been actively working very hard to get ready the facilities for the NGO Forum on Women. And the China NGO Forum Organizing Committee has get ready 70 meeting rooms of various sizes for workshops, seminars, and panels, and also other kind of facilities for exhibitions, cultural events, and exchange of information and ideas. And we have also made arrangements for the NGO participants to visit rural and urban areas, such as factories, schools, farms, nurseries, and even to visit families and households. So we try to let the women of other countries know women of China and let women of China know the women of other countries.
Huang Qicao, Vice President of the All China Women's Federation, was interviewed by Frieda Worden at the final preparatory conference for the 4th World Conference on Women. A few weeks after this interview, on April 4th, the Chinese announced a change in the site of the non-governmental forum. Instead of the stadium in central Beijing that the women's group had been preparing, they must meet in a resort village an hour from the city. Officials said structural problems had been discovered in the first site, but activists noted the effect was to marginalize non-governmental women away from the official UN meeting and away from contact with ordinary Chinese. The resort also lacks a large meeting space for 10,000 or more people, and 30,000 women are expected to attend. The change in plans followed a political shakeup in the Chinese government. Supatra Mazdit of Thailand, the official convener of the NGO forum, has traveled to China to negotiate for another site. For Wings, this is Lisa Hayes.
Women the world over are holding conferences to discuss priorities for the 4th World Conference on Women next fall in Beijing. In Eastern Africa, some have prioritized the environment and the empowerment of the grassroots woman.
African women can do so much and are doing so much. But I feel that we can put our heads together and strategize on how we should really be empowered, especially the empowerment of the grassroots who do so much and who are really the managers and preservers of the environment.
In September 1994, women and men representing 7 Eastern African nations came together for the African Regional Conference on Women, Environment, and Sustainable Development in Kampala, Uganda, organized by the Uganda Women Tree Planting Group. Prabha Bharadwaj recorded some of the speeches.
Now, the African people, like indigenous people the world over, were efficient managers of their environment. Their extreme dependence on natural resources for sustenance made this inevitable. They also possessed invaluable knowledge and techniques for preserving their environment. For example, it was taboo to cut certain trees believed to have water recycling powers. People in a village would wait for the sound of a certain horn, which announced the ripening of some wild fruits, before anyone dared to pick them under fear of death or some mysterious mishaps. Communal grazing grounds for their animals were used in rotation to permit grass to grow and prevent overgrazing, and many more. But the colonial master interpreted all these strange traditional norms as pagan and set out to eliminate them, substituting them with, quote, civilized institutions. The result is that many of these invaluable indigenous techniques for environment preservation and resource management were gradually lost. Africans have thus lost many of their indigenous knowledge of medicinal herbs, of family planning, of controlling hypertension, and of curing many of the diseases associated with their environment.
One of the stated goals of the African Regional Conference on Women, Environment, and Sustainable Development was to help the 7 participating countries implement policies drawn up by the African heads of state who attended the 1992 United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. However, these top-down strategies may not be the best way to proceed.
I've realized that working with grassroots women, instead of coming and imposing ideas on them, you sit with them, discuss what they want, look for solutions for what they want to do, and this will work. And this is what I would call the bottom-up approach. I've done it in my past 3 years in the AIDS program, where we had to sit down and look for solutions for the AIDS epidemic. Communities try to discuss what is the cause of AIDS in their community, what they think is bringing up AIDS in their community, and they try to look for solutions and checkpoints. For example, they feel having discos at night, having weddings at night, is a problem and it's a predisposing factor to getting AIDS. In that way, they say, in this village, no more disco after 6. And they will implement it because they are the implementing agents. But this issue of coming with an idea from national level or from international NGO, come and impose it on the community will not take it up. It is not their priority. They don't feel it is their problem. While in the other incidents of bottom-up, they bring up the problem, they try even to analyze what are the causes of the problem, solutions of the problem, and how best they can put checkpoints to the problem, or even how they can appeal for solutions for the problem.
A position paper from this conference will go to the African Preparatory Conference for the 4th World Conference on Women in Beijing in September 1995. For Wings, this is Ginger Webb.
It's several weeks now since the UN 4th World Conference on Women and NGO Forum ended in Beijing. The effects of the resolutions passed at the conference will influence government policy and women's lives for many years to come. Women garment workers and unionists met in Beijing to discuss the globalisation of garment production, the problems and struggles faced by women working in this worldwide industry, and to set up networks between women around the world. Annie Delaney from the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union of Australia was there. She caught up with Laura Fu, a member of the San Francisco-based Asian Law Caucus, a civil rights advocacy group that represents garment workers in the US. The different perspectives and needs of women was illustrated by the controversy surrounding the use of Esprit tote bags at the conference. Laura explains her group's objections to Esprit's association with the forum.
When we came here, the first thing that happened was we got these tote bags with the Esprit label on it. They provided it to the forum participants to carry their things around in. And they had a little label in there that said Esprit was a company co-owned by a woman and they're committed to equality for women. And we've been working in the garment industry in San Francisco. We've had a long history of experience with Esprit, and we know that Esprit uses sweatshop labor in the production of its garments, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And so we thought that we needed to expose that. We couldn't let that company get away with pretending that it was a progressive company that was for equality for women. And so we put out a leaflet asking people to cut those labels out and send it back to the company to ask them to stop using sweatshop labor and to monitor their contractors to make sure that women got a living wage and worked under humane working conditions. And it caused a little bit of a controversy. The campaign to cut the labels got reported in the Forum 95 newspaper, which is the official newspaper for the conference. And it sort of provoked this response from Irene Santiago, who's the executive director of the NGO, where she defended their choice of Esprit as a socially responsible company. And Esprit themselves coming out saying that they get written guarantees from their suppliers who guarantee that they don't exploit their workers. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to respond in the newspaper before the final edition, but we did put out one more leaflet explaining exactly what Esprit did. Basically, 3 months ago, in March of 1995, the United States Department of Labor did a survey in San Francisco of about 40 shops. There were two Esprit shops among those 40, and both of those shops were found in violation of overtime wage laws and of workplace safety laws. And, you know, we weren't surprised. Every time the federal government does a survey of shops, Esprit shops end up on the list of as being violators. And it's a company with a long history of anti-worker activities. You know, in 1974, its own branch company tried to unionize, and this was about 60 Chinese immigrant garment workers. They were on the picket line in the branch company. Esprit closed that company, that factory down. So the women went out to the Minnesota Street headquarters, and while on the picket line, Esprit called out the police, who arrested all these women for supposedly blocking traffic. They were taken down to the police station, humiliated by being strip searched. And after that, Esprit just busted the union drive by moving its entire operations to Hong Kong, and it stayed in Hong Kong for at least 10 years. Our federal courts found Esprit had violated labor laws by retaliating against the union drive by closing its shop down and ordered Esprit to reimburse these women their back wages. That's the way transnational deal with workers who begin organizing. They just shift from one country to another. Esprit is one of those companies, but Esprit is not alone. There's The Gap, Eddie Bauer, Lee Jeans, just all the brand names that we've heard of. They do the exact same thing. They've moved from the United States to countries like Hong Kong and Taiwan and South Korea, and until those countries' wages went up higher than the transnationals wanted. And so from there, they've moved to Bangladesh and the Philippines and Thailand and Indonesia and Malaysia to get their work done even cheaper. And now a lot of work has moved to China. And the wages in China are even cheaper than places like Thailand. And so it's caused dislocation and unemployment in all the countries that they've left.
Laura Fu from the Asian Law Caucus, speaking with Annie Delaney at the NGO Forum in Beijing. You're listening to Women on the Line.
This has been the first of three WINGS programs, marking the 25th anniversary of the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women, held in China from August 30th through September 15th, 1995. For a link to the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, search online or email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.